So what I want the format to be today, I'm very open to it. You know, last time I was here, Nick suggested that maybe we should have a regular series where I come in with a topic. It's okay, today we're going to talk about contracts and why they're important, you know, or design contracts or services contract. Or today we're going to talk about your LLC, why that's important, convertible debt versus equity. I don't have that plan today. I do intend to, in the near future, create kind of like a series of discussions with specific topics. That way people can pick and choose. But for now, I'd just like to take questions, and then we'll just see where that goes. And I think you guys might ask some questions that might lead me to some other thoughts that I want to share with you. So what I'll say is just any question you have that's legal or startup related, small business related, fire away. As each of you ask questions, I'll just ask you to tell me a little bit about what you're doing so I can provide some insight and hopefully tailor my response towards that. So what questions do you guys have?
This just came up this morning, but have you ever co-worked out, especially a group forming, Justin and I were just working on it, but it was looking at possibly formulating a 501c4 for that group. So the question I have is just how hard is that too much to do for something like that, or is that the appropriate?
So the question is, forming a 501c4, let me just speak generally about forming nonprofits in general. First of all, if you're ever going to try and raise money, you don't want to have a nonprofit because people are investing for profit, I think. You get a lot of people who come with these startup ideas. They, we're going to have a nonprofit arm. That's a terrible startup idea. I mean, no one wants to invest into somewhere where you're giving away their money. As far as forming a 501c4, I've researched it. I understand it. We've never done it before. We do a lot of 501c3s. Forming them for a new entity is very easy to do. The key about a 501c3 or 501c4 is how you're keeping your tax record. So this is really something for your CPA. Forming them is easy. Maintaining them is a little bit more difficult. But it's just really checking a box. You can form a nonprofit corporation in Texas for only $25, and then you actually apply for 501c4 status. So you don't form a 501c4 or 501c3. You form a nonprofit corporation in your home state jurisdiction. And then you apply for 501, you apply to register as a 501c3 or 4 with the IRS. That process can take forever. Now, as a new entity, it's usually easier because you don't have to create you don't have to provide financials and tax returns and whatnot. I can tell you we had an entity that had lost its 501c3 status simply because it hadn't filed the paperwork correctly. It reapplied for it. We had to go back 3 years and prove up paperwork. And it took the IRS about a year and a half to process all of the paperwork. It was, the company didn't have more than a couple $100,000 running through it each year. It wasn't a very complicated company. So if you are ever going to do that, it's easier to do it now upon inception than later. Note, for 501, I don't know 501c4s, but 501c3s have very specific rules on the board of directors. You have to have a certain number of board of directors. They can't be related. They just want to make sure that you have independent, objective people running these things so that the funds are being put away for good use. And I'll make one point about 501c3s. I think they get abused a lot. You see a lot, there was an article that ran a couple of years ago about Alex Rodriguez and his 501c3s where something like 1-5% of the money he raised was going back to a charity. So he's basically using it as a boon to throw these lavish parties in the most posh clubs and hotels and restaurants and whatnot in the biggest cities in America, and then letting his friends donate to it as a tax, as a write-off, but then none of the money was going back anywhere. So as you're forming a 501c3 or C4, if you are going to go out and ask for money into that, you know, it's something you guys do. You might ask for sponsorships from guys like us, like, hey, we've got this co-working movement, and there's a lot of other service providers that would be interested in doing that. You want to make sure that you're representing to them, look, this amount of money is going to go back into whether it's developing this or programs for the community or going to some charity or whatnot.
I actually related to that. I'm working on thinking about starting a 501c3 for an after-school program. I'd always understood you kind of start soliciting for funds. Kind of if you're applying for 501c3, it's a pending yes, but it has a special pending no.
Yeah, that's correct. So the question is, can you start soliciting funds for 501c3 before you have it? You absolutely can, and the IRS will tell you that you can retroactively apply the 501c3 within the calendar year. But the burden is on you. If you do not get the 501c3 status, now you've got to go back to your your sponsors, your, you know, the guys you got donations from, and say, look, you're no longer going to qualify. This is no longer going to qualify as a tax write-off. So yes, the answer is yes, you can do that, but just be careful. But that's just, it's just, the IRS just takes a long time. So if you meet the requirements, you will get the 501c3. It's a check, the, it's a checkbox process. You know, everyone wants to follow this Tom's model where, you know, you're going to, you buy a pair of shoes and then someone else gets a free pair of shoes. So I see people doing this with all sorts of things. Sometimes they're silly things. I mean, you know, you teach someone, you sell someone a book on C++ programming. No one really wants to get a free C++ programming book donated to them. So people have come up with silly things, I think, to try and do that. I think, you know, people should be a little bit more creative or independent in their thought. But the as far as raising money, okay, you're going to go out. First of all, you now have to have two separate companies. If you're going to have a 501c3 arm or a mission, you have to now have two separate companies because you have to have your LLC or your corporation that you're running your company from, and then now you have to manage this 501c3 as a separate nonprofit corporation. Each of those will have its own governance structure, its own legal formalities, its own accounting formalities, or, you know, its own accounting reports to deal with. So one, that's a burden that might not be worthwhile for you. Two, if I'm an investor and you say, okay, we're going to take X amount of money and put it into this 501c3. If I'm an investor, maybe that has a preferred return, I'm looking for my money back, it might be frustrating to me that for every dollar that comes in, they should be paying me back, you're sending 30 cents over here. And for what reason? You're probably not even profitable here at your operating company yet. So investors don't necessarily like that. You do have this social good movement, and I understand that. And I think that crowdfunding is a really neat way of doing that, going out and raising money with very low expectations. I don't want to say that seasoned angel investors and VCs aren't benevolent, because they certainly are. But a lot of times those people have their, you know, wealthy people have their own causes. They have their own philanthropy. They have their own usual kind of philanthropic constitution of what they're trying to do with their money. So if they're going to go invest in a company, they probably don't need that person now adding to their philanthropy. That's just generally what we see in the feedback that we get. For an established company that wants to do it, sure, if you're a long time, you know, if you've been in existence for a while, you say, you know what we're going to do is we're going to start carving out 10% and sending it somewhere. I think it's better just to send it somewhere, not to create your own 501c3. Then I think that's great for an established company. That can be very good for more employee morale, customer morale, keeping customers, positive PR. But for a new startup, and I get these all the time, it's okay, here's what we're doing. I'm doing X, and I'm also at the same time going to have this nonprofit component of it. I always encourage them to think long and hard about that. What else, guys?
Well, I was going to say, I'm 3 years into a startup nonprofit. I follow all the paperwork myself. And I would say if you're, just correct me if I'm making any mistakes here, but some of the things that are really helpful for me and for us was to find a fiscal sponsor instead of making all those promises that you were talking about. So we went to the Dallas Foundation, and they started, you know, they basically, an existing 501c3 will start a fund for you, and you put all your money through that fund. They manage it, they file all the paperwork, you operate as a 501c3, meanwhile you're applying for all your own paperwork, but then you're fulfilling promises as they come in, not like building them up for some future fulfillment.
So what he means is you can actually become an affiliate of another existing 501c3. And yes, and we have several clients that do that. That's a great point. It makes it a lot easier because the 501c3 process can take time, or if you get to that point where now the fiscal year or the tax year is gone and you didn't get your 501c3, well, immediately you can go through a parent or a sponsoring organization.
Yeah, and you know that really worked out well for us because we operated for a complete year as a 501c3. I spent about 2-3 weeks filling out the paperwork. I had actual numbers to plug in through all the accounting questions, and it was a set of realities I was dealing with, not a bunch of, you know, projections. And I think it's a luck of the draw because we filed our 501c3 paperwork, the Form 1023, on December 18th, and I put a letter on the front of it that said, hey, we're a disaster relief nonprofit, and the sooner you can get this back to us, the better, because we have ongoing operations in the field. And January 18th, a month later, I got a call from the IRS agent. I have your 501c3 letter. What's your fax number? It's already in the mail.
That's great.
Yeah, so it took a month.
I like that. Amazing. Great idea.
Yeah, I've got a lot of feedback. Like, there are certain things that
But the other thing is, you're talking about if you want to carve off a piece or like a nonprofit arm, I completely agree with what you're saying. We've gotten involved with this organization called 1% for the Planet. And for any business that's really interested in making a particular statement about donating, I think that's a really good way to go, because 1% really isn't that much, but it's a guaranteed committed amount that you're going to be giving away of your sales revenue each year. And it comes along with this whole branding package. That's the 1% that's on a whole, it's on a lot of different.
What are you giving away?
Money.
Okay.
Like you as a company, like if you want to create a structure.
It's a pledge,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
okay.
It's like you're pledging members, so you become a member company of this organization. You give, and they have a whole host of vetted nonprofits, or one, for example, to which you can donate those funds. And then it plugs you into this community, and they have this whole package of branded material.
So what's it called again?
Called 1% for the Planet.
1% for the Planet, but then they'll help you. So it's very easy to set up. You just send them 1% of your revenues.
No, it's like you, I've never done it from the corporate side, but my understanding of it is, first of all, it started by the people behind Patagonia and a couple of other really big companies. And there's like over 1,500 companies that are involved and a summer number of nonprofits. And I think you as a corporation would go to them. There's some kind of process they're going to put you through just to get you as an approved member of their group. And then you can go through their directory and find certain nonprofits that kind of match up to what you're interested in supporting, and then they connect you, and then you just make the gift straight to the nonprofit. It doesn't go through the 1% of the Planet people. But I think you, I think on the corporate side, you pay them a little bit of something to keep them going and maybe get all the material that they send out. And they have all these incentives and, like I said, branded materials. Like, I mean, if you go buy a bottle of Fiji water, you can see the 1% of the Planet logo on the back, and a lot of different products.
So it gives you the ability to use their message,
right,
to just say that you're a partner
or
a sponsor.
This, yeah, it's like we made this when we're part of this organization. Because otherwise, like you as a company trying to give away, 1, 5, 10%, how do you make people who are following you immediately aware of that on your product? You know what I mean? I mean, 1% for the Planet kind of thing, it's a little more subtle than like, hey, we give this money to so-and-so, you know? It's like right in your face. It's more of a subtleness, which is the way they're trying to. I mean, we've had some success with that.
Good.
Just throw in some ideas.
Do you allocate, kind of where it goes?
Yeah.
Like, if I wanted to, if I'm interested in the arts or something like that.
Yeah. The 1% for the Planet, they have a more environmental focus, but it's a pretty broad definition of environmental, One of them is just like, there's an organization, there's a company called Kamek, and they make camping hammocks. They give money to us, but they also give money for mosquito nets for to prevent malaria cases in Africa.
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay, interesting. What else? What other questions you guys got?
So I don't know if y'all are ready to shift the conversation from nonprofits, but one of the very important questions I've come across in terms of starting a business is. Being a single person is being a sole proprietor versus a single member of LLC. And I know the basic differences in what.
Okay,
LLC
that's a very good prompt. So let's talk about it. The question is sole proprietor versus single member LLC. You're a sole member in this business, right? No partners or co-founders or anything. Which is better? And almost every instance an LLC is going to be better because of the liability. It's the liability protection. What an LLC does is provides a shield for actions or activities by the business. Let's just say you're in an inherently risky business such as trucking. Okay, trucking is a very risky business, especially if you're trucking hazardous materials. These guys are, one, they have insurance through the roof, but they also have at least one, if not multiple layers of corporate protection. That way, if someone's driving the truck, but they're not acting negligently and they just get into an accident, well, the company gets sued, not the individual driver, not the employee, not the owner of the company. For us, we own a law firm. We have malpractice insurance, but outside the scope of what we do, if someone walks into our office and they slip because one of the employees is eating a banana and dropped the banana on the floor, and the person walks in, it doesn't have to be a client. We are open to the public. People can just walk into our office and ask us a question. And they slip on that banana and hit their head, and then they sue us. Well, we have premises liability insurance to cover that, but let's just say they get past the insurance for whatever reason, their damages are beyond our premises liability. Nick's got the same thing here. They could sue, they can't sue me personally. unless I was running behind them, you know, throwing banana peels at their feet, because they would have to sue our entity. And if the entity shuts down, the entity shuts down. I mean, the entity, my entity, our firm makes money, but the money gets distributed. I mean, we pay our employees, we pay our bills, and then if there's anything left, we pay ourselves. You know, or at the end of the year, you pay a bonus structure. There's a bonus structure in place. So hopefully the entity doesn't have a whole lot of money. So if you get sued, well, what's really lost there? I mean, sure, I would hate to lose the entity, but personally it can't be affected. So from a limitation of liability perspective, that's what a corporation does. It provides a shield, right, between customers or services you're providing and accidents or injuries, that damage that could happen, and then you underneath that shield. That shield can be broken, or sometimes they call it piercing the corporate veil, if you're misbehaving or, you know, doing things not in accordance with the law, but a little different. Sole proprietorship doesn't allow that. Now, the other thing that an entity allows is it allows certain favorable tax circumstances. You know, you can take deductions on business expenses. Let's just say, you know, my cell phone. I primarily use a cell phone for work, right? I'm at work mostly during the week. I take calls all the time, so the business pays for the cell phone. I have a work laptop, right? I would work on it. You know, I take it home and work on it, travel. So I have a work laptop. If I didn't have an entity, I would otherwise be paying for that laptop myself. So let's just say the laptop costs $500. Well, in order to make $500, to have $500 of cash, I have to make $750 or $800 because the government takes their share. So you take $800, pay myself, now I have $500 and I can go buy this laptop. If the business is buying it, if the business has $800 in its account and then $500 in its account and spends $500 on the laptop, that is a business expense that gets deducted out of the profits from the business. So there's some favorable things you can do from a tax treatment standpoint on having a business. You could do that in a sole proprietorship. You can still do those things. You can have reasonable business expenses and deductions in a sole proprietorship. You just better keep really good record of those, because it's hard to separate what's personal and what's business. When you have a business, an entity, everything's run through we have corporate credit cards, we have a corporate bank account, corporate financial statements. It's very easy to see, okay, this was a business expense, this was a personal expense. So there's two main reasons why you form an entity. One is limitation of liability, two is for tax purposes. The sole proprietorship, you can get the tax purposes thing, you just have to be very diligent about it. Please do not let that be an excuse. In your business, you should be diligent about your expenses. But it's just a little easier when all your business expenses are in one bank account. If you're a sole proprietorship and you're running a separate bank account for your business-related activities, that helps, but we still don't have any limitation of liability. Generally, I encourage everyone to form an LLC, except for, in some instances, consultants. Consultants, if they don't want to mess with the hassle of an LLC, an LLC is going to cost you $300 in filing fees and another $500 to $1,000 in legal fees. LLC is going to cost you a couple hundred dollars in accounting fees at the end of the year, maybe another couple hundred dollars in attorney's fees each year, just to keep it going and make sure that you're following the right formalities. If you go with a sole proprietorship, you can avoid some of those fees. You need to be very diligent about your records. But like I said, a consultant situation, except for E&O, errors and omissions insurance, if you're working on a large project in a big company or something, there's really very little liability that a consultant working from his or her house will have. So in the rare instances when I have a consultant who's been doing this forever and doesn't feel like forming an LLC, I will be okay with that. But almost always, you are better off forming an LLC. It's just a little bit of an investment cost to shield yourself and then to take the tax advantages. Also, an LLC can set you up for growth. Let's just say you are that consultant. You start hiring people, adding people. You're not going to do them under your sole proprietorship. So, does that answer your question? What else?
What are some of the most common hurdles from a legal perspective that you see with companies that are forming up?
Partnership agreement is probably the most important one. If you're forming a business with someone else, you have to get your agreement down in writing. This is how most startups go. Two guys have an idea, or two guy and a girl, two girls, whatever it is. Two people have an idea. They spend 3 to 6 months dreaming about it at work, talking about how much better their lives would be if they were working on this idea. They start to do it. Maybe one's an engineer, one's a marketing guy. They both say, okay, this is awesome. The engineer is going to build it. The marketing guy is going to sell it. They've got the idea. They go to a couple startup weekend events. I think it's now called Upstart or something. They changed the name, Uplift or whatever it is. They're ready to go. So they go and they quit their jobs, or they get a membership here, or they're here on weekends, they start going. Now they're another 3 months down the road and they're maybe getting close to MVP, or they are maybe applying for an accelerator. They don't have an entity formed yet. That's fine. You don't have to incur the legal fees. But you get 6-9 months into it, and then one guy falls in love with some girl he met at the bar the other night, and all of a sudden he's disappearing every night for a month. You can't get in touch with him. Or just life happens. This guy's wife says, man, we can't do this not working thing, hanging out at Common Desk all every day. I need you to go get a real job and, you know, and bring home some money so we can pay people. So we can live our, you know, live our life. Or your parents get sick, or your kids get sick, or you get sick, whatever. Just life happens. And so now these people are 9 months into it, and this one guy's still doing it, and the other guy's starting to taper off. They always agreed it's 50-50. And now you've got an MVP, you have an investor. Investor shows up and says, I'm ready, what's the ownership? And the guy who's still in it every day says, well, we agree on 50-50, but it really should be more like 90-10. Because I don't want to invest in a company where I've got an absentee founder. I don't want to invest in a company, or I don't want my investors investing in a company where you've got a founder that has a significant equity stake, and they're not spending a lot of time. This happens all the time. And so the answer to that is get things down in writing. You don't even have to go to a lawyer. Just the two of you or the three or four of you sit down and say, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I promise to do. Here's what you promise to do. And here's what we're going to get for it. And we're each going to get 10% right now for coming up with the idea. And then we're each going to have 40% that's going to vest over 2 years. And just put it down and both of you sign it, preferably in front of a witness or a notary or something like that. So that way in 9 months when the other guy has disappeared because he's fallen in love or because he has to spend more time at home, whatever it is, you say, hey, look, man, you signed this thing. So if you're not going to do it, I'm ready to start this company. You don't own this. So the biggest hurdle is partnership issues. If you can afford it, great, go to a startup attorney. You know, new clients coming into us for about $1,500, we can get you pretty far down the road.
I think the key thing you said there was, or the key point was investing. A lot of times you get traded like, okay, 50-50, you know, we're great. I barely know you, but we have the idea together. So
you have to vest, guys. You absolutely have to vest. Unless someone is contributing some huge piece of technology, right? If I had technology that I brought from somewhere else or that I, you know, that I own and I'm contributing, that can be valuable. But other than that, you have to vest over time. Even your shares need to vest. Because if I'm an investor, I'm investing in your company, I'm investing in Nick. What happens if Nick gets hit by a bus tomorrow or moves overseas? Now where's Nick? I mean, we still got the idea, the company owns the idea, but I was investing in Nick and he just left with 40% of the company. And I need to go hire another Nick, so I need that 40% back to go incentivize the next Nick. So the first thing is partnership issues, and I will include vesting. There's a separate one underneath that, very important. Secondly, there are a lot of ancillary costs that go with starting a business that people do not plan for, okay? You know, co-working spaces get rid of a lot of these, and there's a lot, there's so much value in that. When you go and open a space, you're gonna have to most likely find a spot somewhere, and if you have to sign a lease, let's just say you're gonna open a small business, and you're gonna sign a, you know, get a couple thousand square feet, put in a few offices, you have to sign a lease, you're gonna have to personally guarantee it. No way around it unless you're in the shoddiest building of all time, but you're gonna have to personally guarantee your first lease. And then you're going to have to go buy things like copiers or phones or software. Luckily, these days, most software is free or open source, or it's becoming very reasonable. But computers, all those things, you know, people start building out their plans and say, okay, well, this is what it's going to cost us to, I got to get, everyone knows their developer costs. I'm going to spend some money on branding or marketing or whatnot. I'm going to take my, I'm going to pay myself $3,000 a month or whatever it is. So people think about those things. No one ever thinks about where you're going to buy your pen and paper. Where you're gonna get your computers from, where you're gonna get your software from, how you're gonna make your phone calls. I mean, you having a cell phone is fine, but once you start having incoming calls, you can't be taking every call to your cell phone. So I would say that's not necessarily a legal hurdle, but a small business hurdle. Other legal hurdles, independent contractor versus employees. I don't know if this fits anyone here, but we see this all the time. People just go start hiring crazy amounts of people, just calling them all independent contractors. This guy's an independent contractor, this guy's an independent contractor, this guy's an independent contractor. You could have 10 people working in your office and they're calling them all independent contractors. And you can't do that. The laws are pretty clear. If you're an independent contractor, that means that person is probably doing work somewhere else or is free to go do work somewhere else. That independent contractor is bringing their own materials. If it's labor, they're bringing their own tools and their own tool belt and they're driving themselves there. If it's more of a services-based technology-based, they're bringing their own laptop, they're working from home, they're bringing their own software. That's an independent contractor. Someone answering the phones for you or working with you together, employee. Now, I don't want to scare anyone. I mean, I think early on, no one really cares because probably not paying people very much and the whole business is pretty tenuous. But as you get going, a huge mistake It's just leaving everyone as an independent contractor.
What are the repercussions?
Well, the first repercussion is workers' comp. Okay, you could have issues where if you get sued, if that independent contractor gets injured on the job at your place, because you might have thought, well, I don't need workers' comp because I don't have any employees. But that's not necessarily going to be the case. You might, some industries have to have workers' comp, or you have to be a non-subscriber. And if you're a non-subscriber, you have to let people know that you're a non-subscriber. Another issue is unemployment taxes with the state, and then federal withholding taxes. We see the TWC busting in all the time. What usually happens is an independent contractor gets terminated. They file for unemployment, which you shouldn't be able to. If you're truly an independent contractor, you shouldn't be able to file for unemployment. But they talk to their friend, because they're upset, or an attorney. And the attorney says, oh, just go file for unemployment. That's the worst thing for your business, because now the TWC knows who you are, is going to do an audit to see if you're correctly classifying this worker. And even whether you were or weren't, they're now going to go see, make sure you're paying your state taxes right. Even though we don't have state income tax in Texas, you do have to pay a state unemployment tax of 1 to 2.7%, roughly. 1 to 2.7%, I think. On your wages sent out to employees. And of course, federal withholding taxes. If you're independent contractors are supposed to report their own wages, and then they pay the IRS. But if they're not doing that, and the IRS finds out they're not, the IRS can come and audit you and ask for the federal withholding taxes.
Now, how do like large real estate companies that keep all their brokers as independent contractors get away with it? Because they're providing them all providing them here.
But a lot of times those brokers are paying a commission into it, right? So the commissions are being split, is that correct?
Right.
And then if you're not selling anything, don't you usually have to pay for my marketing materials and stuff? Let's say I don't sell anything. Or they count that, they carry that forward, right?
Right.
And you have a monthly fee. So theoretically, if I were a broker and I didn't sell a house for a year, I could walk out owing the company something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's one way around it, is those people are actually paying in. Two, I think there's a pretty strong lobby, real estate lobby in Texas. I haven't sat down. The TWC stuff is not my area of expertise. I'm a corporate guy, but our litigation guys know more about this. It's a very interesting topic. We should probably talk about it further, because there are other areas that I think are similar to real estate brokers that the TWC has come down. TWC's Texas Workforce Commission. TWC has come down and said these guys are absolutely employees. You have to pay them as employees. And I know most real estate brokers operate as independent contractors.
I just hired somebody yesterday. As an independent contractor, they're in a sales position for Rome.
Yeah, so let's not admit to anything. Well, if we're going to put this up on, let's just say theoretically, if you were to hire someone into a sales, if you're to hire one into a sales position, here's my thoughts on that, Nick. Look, man, if you are telling them where to be and when to be there,
yeah.
If they are using your materials, if they're wearing a Rome T-shirt. Just because they're wearing a Rome T-shirt doesn't mean they work for Rome. I mean, those guys that come to your door selling AT&T U-verse or selling security or whatnot, those are all independent contractors. Or selling energy. So it's not, you know, definitive. But if they are under your control, most likely they're an employee. One independent contractor.
I will say this, like the ideas that we have had were to. You know, it's kind of it's a little bit of a part-time job. Generally, it's a job that works well for somebody who's already in commercial real estate.
Right, because they're already in the buildings.
They haven't quite established themselves as a broker yet. And so picking up another job on the side, selling a different product works really well for them. And so it's a way for us to get
I would suggest to anyone in your situation, if you just Google TWC independent contractor test. There's a 20-point test that you can ask you can answer the questions, and it'll, you know, you can see which way you lean. Just finishing out that test is not going to alleviate you from any responsibility, but I think that will help. I will say, if I'm the TWC, I've got one company with one guy that's misclassified that's worth maybe a couple $1,000s to me. I don't know if it's really worthwhile for me to spend my resources. But in general, as you start to grow, then this needs to be something you're very aware of.
Yeah. So, just out of curiosity, if you are working as an independent contractor, you're saying they have to report and they have to pay those taxes that the business would normally have to pay. That person does try to claim unemployment, not...
If they're legitimately an independent contractor,
yeah.
Then you just say this person's an independent contractor, not an employee. And also note, it is not your responsibility to make sure your ICs pay their taxes. That's why you send that W-9 to the IRS.
But if they do pay their taxes, are they eligible for unemployment?
No, not at all. That's only for employees. Let me just think of one or two other legal hurdles for small startups. Watch what you're signing. People just start signing things. I got my credit card, lease equipment, phones, copiers. You're probably signing a lot of personal guarantees. We have a lot of businesses come to us on their way out as they're winding down, or maybe they're just not cutting it anymore. And now I didn't know I personally guaranteed that credit card. We're $12,000 in the hole. Or these phone leases, are 5-year leases, and your business shuts down after 3. The equipment company, they don't want their phones back. Now you owe, $2,000 left on those phones, and copiers can be very expensive. So be mindful of what you are signing. Also, I see a lot of startups get in bed with their developers. I'm not crazy about that, where you find a guy who's going to develop your website for you or your business for you for 30% of your company. No, most reputable firms, firms that have been along for a long time, do not do that. They might have alternative structures. I know some have alternative structures, but they do not take interest from their clients. It's always the guy that's just getting going, and the guy that maybe is leaving somewhere, or just graduated school or whatnot. There's lots of talented engineers and developers here in this town. But I see clients all the time get in bed with these developers. Well, this guy's building my $100,000 website in return for 20% stake in the company. That website's going to take 6 years to get built, because that guy's going to realize that equity does not buy beer. You can't take girls out because you have equity in a company. And he's going to go take another job, and that job's going to become much higher priority than your business. Now you're fighting over 20% of the company and whether this guy finishes obligations and stuff like that.
To the liability protection of the LLC versus the sole proprietor in a startup, as far as financial liability goes, one, does it put you in a stronger position to take out small business loans or any type of loans you have the LLC? And two, if things don't go well and you wind up going bankrupt or something like that, there's protection also on that end of it, not just in terms of getting sued, right, but the loan is being taken out under the company, so
right,
you're not personally responsible.
So let's separate those a little bit. I think it's very important to establish banking relationships, all of you. Find a bank that's close to you, preferably not one of the big banks. If you have any affiliations there, then I'm sorry, but I just have not had good luck with any of the huge banks. They just don't care about you. They don't. But find a bank, a local bank that's here. They will care about you. Someone you can establish a relationship with. We know our bankers because they're in the bottom of our building. We see them all the time. When we need to go ask for a loan, they know who we are. They come to our office. They see that we have clients coming in. They know that we're a legitimate enterprise. Establishing a relationship with a bank is very important, because banks will be the cheapest partner you will ever have. Much, much cheaper to get money from a bank than it is from an investor. Now, it can be very difficult to get money from a bank early on. You probably have to sign a personal guarantee. For any of you who are planning on building a business that's going to grow and that's going to need capital, need working capital, I would highly recommend going to a bank that you like, establishing a relationship, and taking a small loan, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, that you're going to pay back over a year or two, just to establish that relationship and get some good vibes going between you and your business and that bank. That can be very important. When you do go and apply for a loan from the bank, even in the company name, you're going to have to personally guarantee it, because the business is just getting going. So they're really lending money to you, not to the business. But once you've been established for a while and your business has assets, it could be in the firm of furniture and equipment. I mean, we're a small business. I run a small business. We've been around for 6 years. We have tens of thousands of dollars in furniture and equipment. And then we have assets for us, and our assets are accounts receivable. Your assets might be inventory. Your assets might be, intellectual property. So we have assets, our assets are accounts receivable. So if we were to go talk to a bank, the bank would say, okay, well, let me see what your accounts receivable look like. We will loan you money against this accounts receivable. If you're selling a product, we will loan you money against your products. Your inventory becomes your assets. Initially, they're going to require a personal guarantor, but hopefully as your business matures, then you're only borrowing money against the business name. Now, as far as what happens if you default, or what happens if you have to file for bankruptcy? I mean, it depends. If the business is filing for bankruptcy, then the creditors of the business will get in line to get money back from the business. The bank could be a creditor of the business. Your copier lease, your landlord are all creditors of the business. If you're not personally attached to any of those obligations, and when the business files for bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee will work that out and pay those people off as they see fit. If you are personally attached to some of these things, then there's a good chance at that point in time the bank says, okay, well, this business is filing for bankruptcy. This business owes us $20,000. You're the personal guarantor on it. We have a right to waive having to go after the business first. That'll be in every agreement. First, they come to you, by the way, guarantor, now you owe us $20,000. So if you're personally guaranteed on it, then the business isn't going to provide any protection. But if you're not personally guaranteed, then the business provides tons of protection.
So how do you get yourself in a position that you're not the personal guarantor on any of these?
You build a reputable business. Right. So honestly, you start building a good reputation with your business, with your bank, excuse me. So take out a small loan, get a good credit score, right? Having a credit card or two that you pay off regularly will help your credit score. I don't want to encourage anyone to incur credit card debt, but have a good credit score. Your business needs a good credit score. We are just now to the point, I mean, you know, we're 6 years in business where we can do small things and they won't ask us for it. The copier, the phones, lease, you know, purchasing equipment, stuff like that. I don't know, we haven't gone and taken a bank loan in a while, but last time we did take a bank loan, they definitely asked for a personal guarantee. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, they're just lending money to the owners of the business, they're not lending money to the business. So, and because our inventory is accounts receivable, which sounds great, but if the world ended tomorrow and none of our clients ever paid us anymore, then the bank has no inventory. Excuse me, has no collateral. If you have legitimate collateral, let's just say over time Nick buys this building, then Nick could use this building as collateral to go out and borrow more.
Can you tell us a few local banks that you like?
I like BB&T, right over there at Greenville and just south of the Grape. I like those guys a lot. Those guys are very nice. I like, for anyone who's really truly a venture capital type company, someone who's going to be seeking venture investment, Silicon Valley Bank is fantastic for small businesses. And then I have heard great things about Comerica. I know they're a huge company, but since they moved to Dallas, my understanding is they have made a real effort to work with small businesses. So I like Comerica. And then for my real estate clients, it's called the Benchmark Bank. Benchmark's got locations in the Park Cities and in the Plano. Those guys are just kind of old school Dallas guys that know real estate.
I use Grand Bank out of
Grand.
They don't have very many locations. Super
it's almost better that they don't have a lot of locations.
Is Benchmark, they started in Dallas?
They've been around for a long time. Yeah, they merged with someone else a while back.
So is your aversion to the larger banks just because of the inability to get personal attention?
That's
or
correct.
Is it just because, or is it, is there something?
Their loan officers change all the time, mm-hmm. right? The guy who's the loan officer at the Chase branch right here is not going to be there in a year or two. Mm-hmm. He's going to be moving up somewhere else, or he's going to get frustrated with that business. A lot of these smaller banks that are locally owned or that are putting more into the longevity or trying to encourage their employees to stay there for a long time. You want to get someone, you need to know a few people at the bank, but you want to get someone who knows you. So that you, let's just say you have this tremendous opportunity to do a new project and you need $30,000 quickly. To find it could be, you know, you could make a lot of money off of it, but you need $30,000 in, you know, raw materials or to launch the project or whatnot. You don't want to go through an application process with the banks. It takes 30 to 60 days. So hopefully you can call your bank and say, look, you know me, I've been a good customer. Can I get $30,000? You establish a line of credit with it.
Yeah.
So even once you have your banking relationship established, I would show up every quarter or every 6 months. Say, hey, look, here's our financials. We're growing. We're doing good. Remember, we borrowed this money. We paid it back. We're never carrying a balance on our credit cards. Things like that will help. Because ultimately, at the bank level, there's someone making a decision, yes or no. The problem with Chase and Bank of America, they just plug you into a computer.
Yeah.
You either fit or you don't. These smaller banks, it goes up to a committee. The committee says, okay, yeah, we like these guys. We trust these guys. I think this is a good investment. What else?
I have a question. I set up a community platform back in Paris where I know we live. And the idea is the people that can sign up and they have to be, it's a closed environment. We have to accept them. And after they have been accepted, they can then invite their friends. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of built on trust that way. But we're getting elements now that suddenly are trying to change the way, you know, to take decisions on our behalf and things like this, to promote others, their own sites and things. Can we kick them out?
Yes, you should have a terms of, is this all web-based?
Yeah.
You should have a terms of service and privacy policy, which governs the use of your users or your visitors. Yes, you absolutely can. I mean, are they paying anything for this?
No, I mean, it's totally free for them to
do that. Yes, I would kick them out. They don't have any rights. I mean, joining an online community is a privilege. It's not a right.
Mm-hmm.
Once you pay for it, it's a little bit different. You might have some contractual obligation to them, but
yeah.
I would encourage you to review, draft a terms of service and a privacy policy and say the terms of service, you are not to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
If you do, we will remove you.
Okay.
You're not to redistribute our content or invite other people, whatever it is, without our permission.
Mm-hmm.
If so, we'll terminate your membership. We actually just wrote a blog on this, one of my attorneys did, on the website, Vela Keller, Merrick, and Nick can get you there. And we wrote a whole blog about privacy policy and terms of service and why they're important. So I think reviewing that would be very helpful.
Yeah. So that counts at the same time. If somebody borrows an ad from another member and kills his mother-in-law, we're not liable somehow.
I mean, yes. That would be very difficult for you to be found to be wrapped into that.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, that's what you do this thing. You say, look,
mm-hmm.
we're only responsible for the content here. What you do with it, you're not supposed to take it, but if you do, we're not liable. Also, we're not liable if you upload lewd photos. We're not liable if you upload a photo and then you get mad because someone saw it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and also the minute you upload a photo, we own it. So a traditional terms of service for a social-based community
yes.
like that would have all those elements in it. You know, it's the way Craigslist, have tried suing Craigslist, but unsuccessfully, right? Because you had those Craigslist killings. People get robbed off of Craigslist all the time. Craigslist just provides the information. How you use it, that's up to you.
They don't even provide the information, they just provide the platform.
Provide the platform, that's correct. You're right. Information is provided by the users.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do
you
one more.
You can find that standard boilerplate sort of thing you're looking for and just tweak it. That's what we did for our website. They have online versions.
Honestly, look, I mean, there's no substitute for an attorney. And the thing about doing these sorts of things with an attorney is because, yes, we do terms of service and privacy policies all the time. We charge a flat fee for them, and they all look pretty similar. Not exactly, but they all look pretty similar. But the benefit, if you were to engage us, is I want to know your business. So that you come to me with a contract issue, or we come to me with a litigation issue, I already know where this came from. But a good stopgap, a good short-term solution would be to pull something, a boilerplate template, and use it. I'll take one more, guys.
I guess question as far as it's kind of back on the employee topic, but when someone has their own business, a single person, then they get ready to hire somebody, what's the first legal step that ought to happen?
You know, you don't even have to have an employment contract. I mean, Texas is an at-will state, so you can fire anyone at any time for any reason other than the wrong reason. You can't fire them because of their race or their color or their creed or, you know, or their belief system. But other than that, I mean, if you just don't like them, you can fire them. Nothing wrong with that. The first thing you want to do is set up on payroll. How do you get a good payroll set up? This is, again, that's more of an accounting question than anything. And you can find payroll at, you know, Bank of America. Most of the banks offer it, ADP, SurePayroll, Paychex. Lots of different companies offer it. So payroll's not hard. I would have them sign an employment agreement, which says a couple of things. One, you're not going to compete with anyone. You're not going to compete with us while you're here. I don't want you stealing my secrets. Two, whatever you create while I'm paying for you, the company owns. If they come up with a better way to slice bread, and it was on your dime, then your company should owe that, not them individually. That's important. One thing that people don't always put in employment agreements that we do is termination procedures. If you get terminated, you immediately have to turn back everything that's ours that's in your possession. Because a lot of times they might have an iPad or a laptop or some notes or stuff at home, and they'll screw you. You fired me, I'm keeping this stuff. But you don't want them to have that right. You want it to be an obligation. They have to return that back to you. So an employment agreement would be a good one. Again, check our website. Look, guys, we are very active. My goal is to be able to help all these basic questions that you guys are not going to attorneys for because you're not ready to spend for it, but what you're doing instead, you're just looking it up on the internet, which is fine, and I get that. We're going to have a lot of these materials on our website. So we blogged about a lot of things. I'm in the process of uploading some standard contracts. I've already got a standard NDA up there. You can all use it. I'm going to put a standard independent contractor agreement up there. You can all use that. I'd rather have people using good templates and give them away. So I'd really encourage you to check out our website. Or if you are going to pull this stuff, look for other law firms. Because if I'm just a guy who puts up an independent contractor agreement, who cares? What reputation do I have to worry about? If I'm a law firm and I'm going to put this up there, I'm going to make a comment about it. Well, one, you have ethical rules that you have to be bound by. And then two, I've got a reputation. I don't want someone commenting saying this thing was terrible or don't use this. So anyway, if you're not ready to go hire an attorney to draft an employment contract, I at least put some things in writing. Can't compete while he's working there. If you're paying him enough, can't compete for 6 months or 9 months after he leaves, maybe after a year. Don't steal your intellectual property. Whatever he creates is yours, and upon termination, you get your stuff back.
What's kind of y'all's process? Say we do have already in place a partnership agreement, so kind of y'all's process, can you review this and like advise on
the best steps? Unless it was already drafted by someone else, unless it was drafted by an attorney and we're modifying it for a specific purpose because we're adding new members or someone selling, it's probably best just to come in. We'll look at it, but just come in and just let it start from scratch. I say start from scratch, we realize, and we represent hundreds of guys, if not thousands of small businesses. I mean, I can't tell me LLC formations we've done in the last 6 years. So whatever you're doing, we probably already have. I can probably think of another company that's similar, and I've got a starting point. We generally charge, for forming a new LLC, we charge $1,250 for single member, $1,500 for multi-member. That's $300 of that is filing fees. So if we're just reviewing a partnership agreement between two people, we're rewriting it, probably going to charge between $750 and
$1,000. Well, yeah, for me, I'm talking more about a dissolution, like to get out of the deal or like maybe like retain certain assets like logos or designs.
Sure,
like
sure. So a dissolution, that would probably just, we need to discuss that.
Okay.
You're looking at $750 to $1,500 maybe, I guess.
What about for like kind of almost like all the card things, like the privacy, you know, statement or something like I'm working on an app.
Yeah, so a lot of this stuff is listed on our website because we do it all the time and we'll just tell you what we'll charge for it. We will do that a la carte. In a single contract, I need an independent contractor agreement, an employment agreement, I need a privacy policy, I need terms of service. Those things, yes, we can just flat fee it for you. Here's what it's going to cost. We can do that pretty quickly. What I don't like, and what if you're going to work with an attorney or another attorney, you don't want to go to him and say, okay, well, I need to do these 10 things. And then he's going to say, okay, that's going to cost you $2,500. I really want to spend $500 now. Where should I get started? I think a good attorney is going to tell you, look, man, if you need to do these 10 things, you need to do these 10 or at least these 5. Just doing the first one. I get a lot of guys say, well, just do this part. But I know if we just do the first thing, that's immediately going to lead to 2 and 3. I'm just putting you in a worse position than you were in already. So be mindful of that. I think our rates are pretty reasonable. There's some really great startup attorneys around town that I know have very reasonable rates. But if you're going to build a business, you have to do some big boy things. And one of them is paying your advisors and attorneys and your service providers, attorneys and accountants. They don't have to be outrageous. I mean, Elizabeth Adams worked out of here for years and for a long time. She's fantastic. She's very well priced as an accountant. So you don't have to pay downtown rates, but also you shouldn't expect to get cut rates for those types of things. It's just too important. Anything else? No? Okay. Sure, guys.